Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, March 31st, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as today we discuss class action litigation. I'm Dean Reuter, General Counsel and Vice President at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two guests to our call today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 10 minutes, although we're going to begin with Mr. Andrew Grossman, who's going to give us background on some pending legislation. So he's going to have a few extra minutes for that before he gives us his own views. Andrew Grossman is a partner at Baker & Hostetler right here in Washington, D.C. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. We'll hear after him from Professor Howard M. Erickson. He's professor of law at Fordham University School of Law. And with that, Andrew Grossman, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. What we're talking about today is the Fairness in Class Action Litigation and Furthering Asbestos Claim Transparency Act of 2017, which I'm sure that if you add up that acronym, it comes out to something very compelling. Oftentimes, when there's a dispute over policy, I find that the truth lies somewhere in between. But here, there might be more than the usual amount of space between the bill's supporters and its opponents. According to supporters, and this is a direct quote, the bill consists of, quote, common sense reforms to check abuses in class action and multi-district litigation. According to opponents, the bill is, quote, sinister, would, quote, gut class actions, quote, would destroy lives, is, quote, twisted, Orwellian, and according to the group Public Citizen, quote, the aim is to wipe out class action lawsuits. My hope for this discussion is that we'll be able to cut through the rhetoric a little bit, take a close look at some of the provisions in the bill, and come up with a more detailed and, I hope, nuanced perspective of what it is that the legislation actually does. I'm going to begin with a general summary of the bill and highlight several of its provisions, and then turn to offering my thoughts on those provisions. I think a tiny bit of background is in order. Many of the provisions of the bill are aimed at a particular phenomenon, one that I should note is not without its own controversies. I'll refer to it by the title that's used by folks, I suppose, on probably the defense side of the debate, typically so-called no-injury class actions. And that's where only a portion of class members have suffered present-day injuries due to, say, an allegedly defective product. And so the remainder of class members have not yet been injured, and indeed they may never be. Over the past 20 years or so, these types of no-injury class actions have been on the rise quite considerably. Critics say that they're bad for consumers because they drive up prices, and that they're bad for actual victims who can get shortchanged in settlements that tend to focus on the larger class of uninjured class members, but that at the end of the day, they're great for class attorneys. Meanwhile, supporters of these types of broader classes claim that they do provide reasonable compensation for a broad group of consumers in an effective and efficient fashion, and thereby deter companies from engaging in bad conduct and make sure that there's an adequate incentives across the economy to prevent and protect against defective products and improper services, fraud, and so on. I'm sure that we're going to discuss this phenomenon more and probably have perhaps have slightly different views on it, but I think it's important to understand, at least as a matter of background, what it is that the bill has been drafted to target. So leaving aside the multi-district litigation provisions of the bill generally speaking makes three different kinds of changes to the class action procedure. Now, the first is that it requires the classes be defined with both greater precision and cohesiveness. Under the bill's approach, class members have to suffer, quote, the same type and the same scope of injury. Moreover, membership in the class must be ascertainable by objective means and in a way that permits distribution of any monetary relief to class members. If these prerequisites are not satisfied at the outset of a class action under the bill's approach, then the class action cannot be certified. Second, it attempts to address some of the perceived conflicts that can arise between class attorneys and class members, as well as among different types of class members. To that end, it requires class attorneys to disclose any relationship with the named plaintiff, and it bars representation when the named plaintiff is a relative or an employee of the attorneys. It also requires the disclosure of any third-party litigation funding on the basis that in some instances those third parties may attempt to exert some degree of control over the litigation. And I think most controversially, it requires the class members receive compensation themselves before the determination and payment of any fee award to the class attorneys. It also requires that the fee award must be based on the actual compensation distributed to class members as well as any equitable relief. These provisions, so far as I can tell, are the ones that have received the most pushback. Along a similar vein, it also requires extensive reporting on the distribution of money, both to attorneys as well as to class members, so that the Federal Judicial Center can produce an annual report on how well class actions are actually serving class members. Finally, the bill attempts, at least its sponsors say, to level the playing field in the initial stages of class actions by trying to alter the incentives that can often lead to early settlements before the merits of the case have been fully vetted. To that end, it limits discovery while a motion to dismiss is pending, as well as a challenge over the certification of the class. And it allows for immediate appeal of decisions granting or denying certification so that those can be immediately reviewed by the Court of Appeals. Moving on to my somewhat more normative remarks on this legislation, I think the way to look at this is to understand that context here is key. To understand what this bill is trying to do, you really have to understand the practical reality of no injury class actions. And at that point, you may or you may not agree with the approach that the bill takes, but at least you'll be able to see the logic of its approach and judge it against what it is its drafters are attempting to do. So let's back up a little bit. What does a no injury class action look like? Well, let's give an example. In our example, we'll talk about roofing shingles, the things you might put on your house every decade or two decades to protect against rain and snow and so on. The allegation in one particular case from which I've drawn these facts was that the manufacturer of roofing shingles misled consumers when it said that the shingles met a particular industry standard, which is identified by some long combination of letters and numbers. The class there consisted of everyone who purchased that item. In other words, the class attorneys and the named plaintiffs who put together the class, that was the group of persons whom they purported to represent in this particular litigation. So that included homeowners whose shingles had already failed through exposure to the elements, but had failed allegedly earlier than they would have had they met the given industry standard. It also included homeowners whose shingles might fail in the future. But it also includes many, many homeowners who had also suffered no injury as of yet and perhaps would suffer no injury ever. In litigation over certification of the class, the Seventh Circuit held that the class could in fact be certified because the district court could determine on a class-wide basis whether the allegedly false statements about this particular certification had led to higher failure rates and thereby defrauded the consumers. If so, the class members would then be compensated accordingly based on the increased likelihood of failure. Fine. I think that in a certain way makes good intuitive sense. But without speaking to the exact specifics of that example and that precise litigation, I think there are a few general problems with that approach. The first one is that no injury class members may in fact never be injured. They may be perfectly happy with the product. For example, in our shingles example, shingles that were installed a certain way might not fail with any greater regularity than shingles that had met the specified industry standard. That might be true in areas with certain climates. You could imagine a large number of factual scenarios where certain class members of this no injury class, might never suffer any injury due to the alleged defect. In fact, from their point of view, there may not even be a material defect to the product. Now, of course, under most states' laws, and when you're dealing with state laws, lack of injury would be fatal to a claim. And yet, in this type of no injury class action, that class member is still a part of the class. And so you wind up potentially with a different result than you would under individualized litigation. But I think there's a much bigger problem than that obvious potential issue. The bigger problem is that this type of no injury adjudication can actually shortchange those who actually are injured. What happens is that no injury members are used to dramatically inflate the size of the class and thereby the size of the settlement figures, because almost all of these cases wind up being settled if they are certified, as well as the resulting attorney fee award. Now, to obtain class treatment, class attorneys may have to agree to waive or at least not bring certain claims involving present harm, because those types of claims may require individualized treatment. So in our example, that might include people whose shingles have already failed, people whose shingles are in the process of failing, people who believe that their shingles should be able to withstand certain types of weather. They might be extreme weather events like tornadoes or hurricanes. These could be very fact-intensive type claims, but of course, at the end of the day, they're also the ones that have the greatest potential payout on an individualized basis. Across the entire class, however, they surely pale in comparison to the very large number of consumers who purchase the shingles and would merely be entitled to claims for the, you know, presumed diminution of value based on the misleading statements made regarding the shingles. So those types of damages to the entirety of the class potentially are more uniform, so they can be subject to class treatment, but at the same time, they're going to be somewhat speculative, and on an individualized basis, they're going to be much, much lower. So indeed, the incentive for class attorneys, therefore, is to include no-injury class members so as to drive up the settle amount as much as possible and drive up potential fees, while potentially not including these greater value individualized claims. And with the result that they may not actually be increasing compensation for individual putative clients, in other words, class members, but are increasing the aggregate potential award. The result of all of this is either through an express settlement provision or in some instances through res judicata to bar claims of actually injured class members. Now, this can happen in another way as well. Settlements also typically bar any future claims relating to a product defect. So for example, if your roof fails in the future, that consumer may not be able to be fully compensated for that. The entire compensation to which they would be entitled would simply be the relatively small payments that would be made available to all class members. In other words, they would be severely undercompensated for the injury that they actually wind up suffering in the future. The result is that class members who suffer an actual injury, whether in the present or in the future, stand to lose out big time. And the rest potentially get the right to small payments, which in the average consumer class action, none of them will claim. Claim rates tend to be very, very low, but in consumer product type class actions, they typically range from about 1 to 10%. And according to one large claims administrative company, in many consumer class actions, they average about 1/20th of 1%. Now, why is it that so few people would claim money that is simply being made available to them? Well, you know, we've all gotten emails that contain a large amount of legal boilerplate and tell us that at the end of the day, if we can come up with proof that we bought X, Y, and Z, and we've got our receipts from 8 years ago, and we've jumped, and if we have all that and we jump through a number of hoops, we can claim an injury of $10 or $5, or in the past, perhaps a coupon for some type of service, or now in some cases, they don't call them coupons, but they call them vouchers. So in all of these instances, class members who actually haven't suffered any present injury aren't really likely to pay a lot of attention to the litigation, and they're certainly unlikely to claim settlement funds because it can be burdensome to do so, and the reward is often so low. The result is that almost no money goes to class members, and the claims of those who actually do get injured are wiped out. The attorneys, meanwhile, potentially get millions of dollars because the fee award is typically based both on the amount of work that they undertook as well as the potential award to class members. And indeed, in some settlements, attorneys can actually even get unclaimed funds from the settlement fund, in other words, money that was earmarked for injured class members but was never in fact claimed by them. And in other instances, attorneys are allowed to direct those unclaimed funds to perhaps a preferred charity or other group. In many cases, the attorney's alma mater, or in some cases we've seen even the judge's alma mater. The strange thing is that many cases, or I guess I should say the counterintuitive thing, is that defendants can be okay with these kinds of broad settlements because they really do reduce legal risk, particularly regarding uncertain future claims, and they can serve to cap total liability. Rather than roll the dice and see how things turn out in a massive consumer class action, rather than spend potentially millions of dollars in attorney's fees, and rather than face actual individualized litigation that could balloon to millions of dollars in the future, they get to simply put a cap on their total liability, do a one-time payout, and then write off the rest of it. And in some instances, these expenses may be covered largely or entirely by their insurers. I think the bottom line is that when you have in a single class people who have both been injured, people who haven't been injured, as well as people who may be injured in the future, there are going to be inherent conflicts between those different groups of people, and those conflicts can be enormous, with the result that the people who are hurt the most often tend to get the short end of the stick. So if you step back a little bit and you look at these types of no-injury class actions, you tend to wind up in one of two situations. You either wind up with largely inflated classes based on unlikely injuries, in which case costs to business are being driven up, and those costs are ultimately passed along to consumers who have to pay more for products and services. Conversely, if there actually are injuries and there are serious product defects, design defects, or other types of legitimate claims, oftentimes you wind up shortchanging actual victims. So, all right, how do you fix this policy problem of these no-injury class actions? Well, if you actually look at the provisions of the bill, they seem to take a fairly straightforward approach. The way to begin, obviously, is simply to require the class members suffer the same type and scope of injury. It doesn't need to be exactly the same, but there should be enough similarities so that class members aren't going to be pitted against one another, and so the class council don't face the incentives to drive up the number of no-injury members in the class and to regard those no-injury members in such a way so as to disadvantage the actual injured members or likely to be injured members of the class. So this simple type of uniformity, ensuring greater cohesiveness of the class, serves to eliminate many of the conflicts that exist in class action litigation, and it prevents cutting short the individual claims of those who actually will face an injury. Another thing is to require the class to be defined clearly right up front at the beginning of the litigation, as well as to require a realistic plan to make sure that the class members actually get compensated should there be a settlement or should the case actually go to trial. And indeed, that's what the bill's ascertainability provisions do. They seem to require nothing more than that. Another thing you'd probably want to do to deal with some of these inherent conflicts would be to wait until the end of the compensation process to determine attorney's fees and to pay out those fees. And indeed, you'd probably also want to base that payment on how much the class actually received. These are just simple measures to make sure that class attorneys are actually working for class members. In other words, the parties that they're actually claiming to represent. Now, we could go through the rest of the bill, but I think you get the point. To understand the problem is to understand why these kinds of reforms are good for class members. And you can also understand at the same time why class attorneys might oppose them. In this instance, just like in class litigation itself, the interests of class members and class attorneys may not always be in perfect harmony. And indeed, in some instances, they can be in sharp conflict. I think that's the realization underlying this legislation, and that really is what it hones in on very precisely. Now, with that said, I'm sure that Howard has many different views on this particular bill, and I'm very interested to hear what he has to say. So let me turn it over to him.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. So I teach civil procedure, and I think about procedural reform in all sorts of contexts. And whenever I think about procedural reform, whether I'm thinking about reforming summary judgment or pleadings or class actions or anything else, the first step is I try to be clear on what job this procedure is supposed to do. And then I try to be clear on where the actual problems are and how to fix them without undermining what's good about the procedure as part of our justice system. So my starting point is really to ask, what's the point of class actions? And I do think it's important to start there because implicit in H.R. 985, this new bill, is a deep skepticism about the value of class actions. So let me just quickly lay out several of the arguments for what class actions are supposed to be doing when they're going right. The first is that sometimes there are meritorious claims, that is, situations where on the facts and the law, the plaintiff deserves to win, but the claims are too small to litigate individually as a practical matter, and yet the harm is widespread. And so in the aggregate, we're talking about very substantial wrongdoing and very substantial harm. In those situations, the class action is a brilliant solution. Using representative litigation is a smart mechanism for aggregating the claims so that they can be adjudicated on a wholesale basis. It's a way to use economic incentives for entrepreneurial lawyers to pursue litigation so that we get adjudication of claims that would otherwise go unadjudicated. Second, remedy. There are disputes that call for widespread remedies rather than piecemeal remedies. This is true whether we're talking about injunctive remedies against government actors or corporate actors, or monetary remedies where what we need is some efficient, consistent, final process for distributing a remedy. The class action is, in the right cases, a fantastic way to do that. And third, judicial control. Even without class actions, there's going to be mass litigation. We live in a world of mass production, mass communication, mass marketing, and so forth. There are going to be mass disputes, and they will be litigated on a massive basis. But when mass litigation happens outside of class actions, as it often does, it's messier, it's less controlled. The class action device allows much more judicial control over the process. Most importantly, judicial control over appointment of the class action lawyers, judicial control over fees, and judicial control over approval of proposed settlements. Now, just because class actions do useful work, that doesn't mean, of course, that there are no problems. So what are the problems these days with class actions? One huge problem, I'll mention three. One big problem is settlements that benefit class counsel but don't provide any meaningful benefit to the class members themselves. This is what Andrew was talking about when he mentioned coupon or voucher settlements and certain settlements involving CPRA relief where money goes to charities and claims where the class lawyers and the defendants know that there's going to be a very low claims rate, and yet they try to persuade the court that the settlement has some inflated value so that the judge will approve the deal and award fees to the lawyers based on that inflated value. I think that's a real problem. I think judges are starting to wise up to it, but I think it still needs to be addressed more, and this is the primary thing I've been writing about lately. Second, there's the problem that class actions have become unavailable in some settings because companies require their employees or their customers to waive their right to pursue claims on a class action basis. I think that's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. And third, there's the problem of state court magnet jurisdictions, cases that involve national market disputes and yet end up being resolved, at least in part, in particular state courts where plaintiffs are drawn because they think they'll get a friendly reception. CAFA, the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005, largely addressed this problem as it relates to class actions, but it remains an issue in non-class mass litigation. So this new bill, H.R. 985, it tries to address at least the first and the third problems I just mentioned, but I think it does it sloppily. And when I look at the bill, when I look at the particular provisions and when I look at the bill as a whole, it seems to me that it's taking a sledgehammer to problems that require chiseling. So the bottom line is, if I were a senator, I would vote no on the bill. There's some good stuff here, but I just see no sensitivity to trying to preserve what's useful about class actions. On just a few of the particular provisions. So one of the provisions that Andrew mentioned is the one that requires the same type and scope of injury. A class action can't be certified unless the plaintiffs show that they suffered the same type and scope of injury. So this would amend Rule 23. This would amend the class cert requirements of Rule 23A and B. It's already required for class certification that the proponents of the class action demonstrate commonality, typicality, adequacy of representation, the predominance of common questions over individual questions, and the superiority of class action as a way to resolve the dispute. As Justice Scalia said in the Walmart opinion, what commonality means is there has to be some glue holding the class action together. There has to be sufficient cohesiveness. It seems to me that Rule 23 does the work that needs to be done. Courts, in particular the Supreme Court of the past decade or so, have interpreted the rule strictly And scope of injury doesn't seem to me to add anything useful in terms of figuring out what cases really are best suitable for class, best suited to be adjudicated on a class-wide basis. If you imagine some situation where there is a wrongful act by a government or by a corporation, and that harmed many people, and the causal link is common among them, that case may very well be a perfectly suited case for class treatment, even if the injuries vary quite a bit, even if the injuries vary in the scope and type. So I don't think that this provision is a useful way or a targeted way to address the issue of no injury claims, whatever one may think of them. And another interesting provision is the provision about a discovery stay. The statute would require that discovery be stayed, discovery and other proceedings be stayed whenever defendants make motions to dismiss or certain other early motions in the litigation. So I teach procedure. Some things are better governed by simple rules, and some things are better handled through discretion. This is not one of those things where a one-size-fits-all solution makes sense. Every case is different. And so the order in which a district judge handles motions to dismiss, lets discovery move forward, handles class issues, forum issues, and so forth, the idea of trying to dictate that by congressional meddling rather than leaving it to the discretion of the district judge seems to me really misguided. It also seems to me an invitation to frivolous motions. It's going to be very tempting for defendants to file, even if a smart, careful lawyer for a defendant would have been disinclined to file a particular motion, because the motion just doesn't have much merit in the particular case. I worry that the defendants are gonna find it just too appealing to get that discovery stay and delay the process for plaintiffs. So that provision seems to me a bad idea. The interlocutory appeal provision. This would alter the procedure we currently have under Rule 23F. The current process allows appeals from any grant or denial of class certification, but it's at the discretion of the Court of Appeals. The proposal in the legislation would make it mandatory. So there are easy denials of class cert, and we really don't need appeals from those. There are easy grants of class cert, and we really don't need interlocutory appeals there either. I think the federal courts get it right in generally disallowing interlocutory appeals because they just gum up the works, impose additional delays and costs, and more litigation. So I wouldn't tinker with the current interlocutory appeal process for class cert decisions. So the bottom, I mean, there are also really interesting provisions that I haven't mentioned, but the bottom line is, on the substance, I would like to see changes so that judges reject unfair settlements and so that attorneys' fees in class actions reflect the actual value that they achieve for the class. But I don't want to see changes that make it difficult to pursue class actions, even in the very cases that are best adjudicated on a class-wide basis. And I'll conclude with a word about process. I think Congress got it right in 1934 in adopting the Rules Enabling Act and setting up a careful, deliberative process for amending the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The Advisory Committee on Civil Rules has been diligently working on amendments to Rule 23. There was a good set of amendments to Rule 23 in 2003. There is a good set of amendments to Rule 23 that's currently pending. when Congress, I know Congress has the constitutional power to regulate procedure in the federal courts, but that doesn't mean it's always a good idea to exercise that power. And I worry that in this bill, Congress is sort of clumsily meddling in stuff where the courts and the Rules Enabling Act amendment process have been carefully working on the issues for a number of years.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, very much. I want to open the floor to questions before I give Andrew Grossman a minute or two to respond. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or even both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to our audience, let me mention that our next scheduled telephone conference call on Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at the same number will feature the Fourth Circuit Court Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson. He's got a new book out, All Falling Faiths. That can be found on our website, including a link to the book. That's Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Today, of course, we're talking about class action, litigation, and legislation. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, but as promised, let's go back to Andrew Grossman, give him a minute or two to respond to anything you've heard, and then I want to hear once again from Howard Erickson. Andrew Grossman.
Thank you, Dean. I really did enjoy Howard's remarks, and I think there actually are several important points of agreement. I really do agree that I think part of the way that one views this legislation depends on the way one views the role of class actions. I like the concise way that I heard Andrew Trask at McGuire Woods put it. There really is this distinction between those who view class actions as enabling, self-appointed enforcers to punish and deter bad conduct, and that's their purpose, versus those who just view them as providing an efficient mechanism to compensate injured parties. But I think the problem that we have now is the incentives that have been set up by our existing system really don't meet either criterion. They're not particularly good at providing appropriate deterrence because they enable some amount of actually a large amount of collusion between plaintiff's counsel and defendant's counsel in a way that potentially can undermine ultimate consumer interests and can undermine the interests of class members. And at the same time, they clearly don't do a very good job of providing compensation to people who've actually been injured. I think there's a broad recognition of that. But the problem is that while the courts do a very good job in managing individual cases, and I agree with Professor Erickson on that point, I think they can be inattentive and sometimes unaware of the broader incentives that drive consumer class action litigation. And, these are the phenomena that we see coming up in case after case, all these cases you see reported on with, very strange and one-sided settlements, or all the settlements where consumers at the end of the day wind up getting very little money and other money goes to Cypre Awards or it goes to attorney's fees. But the one place it doesn't go is into consumers' pockets. Just to comment very quickly on a couple of the areas that Professor Erickson addressed, as to discovery stay, I actually think that's a pretty sensible provision because we have a lot of experience with that under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act. Now, that was enacted about 20 years ago, and opponents at the time said it would kill securities class actions, and of course it didn't. They're continuing on at about the same rate. The problem you have in so many class actions, as the Supreme Court has recognized, is that merely the threat of discovery expenses can push cost-conscious defendants to settle what can sometimes be even anemic defense, even anemic cases before they reach trial. So a discovery stay is something that can be I see as being a narrowly targeted solution to that specific problem. And on the margin, it may increase the filing of these kinds of motions. But I think as a practical matter, you see motions dismissed and you see disputes over certification in probably the vast number of cases. So I don't think it's going to affect that aspect of procedure very much. And of course, there is a provision in it, an exception that is, for targeted discovery. As for the interlocutory appeal procedure, I have to admit, I may actually agree with Professor Erickson's reluctance to that. Because it is the kind of thing where you can imagine that actually might change litigation, that might alter litigation conduct, and it certainly is the kind of thing that could draw out class actions for a long period of time. At the same time, you know, everybody recognizes, what from the plaintiff's side is sometimes called the death knell issue, where class certification is denied, but you still have to litigate the individual claims, which may not be worth very much. Before getting to appeal that, or conversely, on the defendant's side, having to face the risk once certification is granted, that there may be an unusually large award that, after all these proceedings, a court of appeals is going to be unlikely to vacate or reverse. But in general, I agree that the purpose of legislation from Congress shouldn't be to put a thumb on the scale for or against class actions, because at the end of the day, they are a procedural mechanism. But what I think this bill does, and what I think it does very well, is to recognize that the incentives have become skewed, that there's a group of attorneys that are taking advantage of these incentives in a way that I think was never intended, that reaches results that really aren't, I think, what Congress or states expected under the applicable substantive laws, and that at the end aren't really promoting any view of what it is that class actions ought to be doing. I think at the margins, there may be areas for compromise where the bill can be changed, and indeed, it already has been changed several times in this legislative process. But I think overall, it is a sensible approach to adjusting those incentives in a way that we will see more valuable class actions and fewer of these no-injury class actions that result in so many of these problematic settlements that I think people, no matter what their view is, do tend to bemoan.
So, Howard Erickson, go ahead.
Yeah, I think Andrew's on exactly the right track in saying that the big problem is the problem of, he used the word collusion. I don't think collusion is quite the right word, but I think the problem he's getting at is that there's a set of aligned incentives between defendants who are looking to wipe out any potential liability with regard to some conduct, and class action lawyers who are looking to make a bundle by settling the class action. So those interests align beautifully. They both want to achieve a deal of maximum scope. And cynically, the concern is that neither one of them really cares very much about what happens to the actual class members. So I think both Andrew and I see that as a real problem. And then the question is this bill a sensible, targeted way to deal with that problem? Obviously, I think it is not. I think that's a problem that has to be addressed through the settlement approval process. And when thinking about the problems, the real problems in class actions, I think the real problems are almost entirely about negotiated settlements that are bad deals, that ought not to be approved. I think if courts were more willing to withhold their approval of deals that don't really provide anything for the class, then class action lawyers would be reluctant to pursue the kinds of class actions that aren't going to get them anything other than meaningless relief. Let me just say a quick word about the no injury issue. So Andrew frames the bill as being mostly a response to the no injury concern, and I really see it quite differently. When I look at the provisions of the bill, I see a dozen or so significant procedural reforms, all of which address a wide variety of cases, including cases in which every single class member has suffered a real injury. So it seems to me if the concern is that there are certain plaintiffs who have no claim on which they ought to win as a matter of substantive law, then the answer is a 12b6 motion. The answer is standing. The answer is dealing with the substantive law on claims of future harm based on past wrongs. And again, when you actually look at the provisions in this bill, you see a whole bunch of provisions that really are not targeted to address that problem at all, but instead would make it more difficult for people to pursue class actions even in cases in which every single class member has suffered a very real injury.
All right, we do have a couple questions pending, so let's now open the floor to questions and take our first call. Go ahead, caller.
This is Sam Miarelli in Orlando. I'm calling just sort of a question on the bill because, you know, I object to a few of these things. And, of course, always get called names and all sorts of other pleasant things by the plaintiff's bar. And it seems that there's been sort of an opening of the floodgates because of the In Re Online DVD case out in the Ninth Circuit where they basically said that a gift card's not a coupon and are really starting to erode the CAFA by taking advantage of the fact that Congress didn't define the word coupon, which, you know, seems mildly absurd when you think about it, but it is what it is. And I'm wondering if there's been any talk in this updated piece of legislation of tightening that up to reduce the end run that they're doing out on the left coast around the coupon restriction.
Sure. So this is Andrew Grossman. The legislation as it's drafted does not address that directly. And I wonder, as a general matter, you know, given the way that some courts have been unwilling to enforce you know, the plain meaning and I think obvious intent of the coupon ban by allowing things like gift cards or I think in one or two cases, vouchers, which, you know, so far as I'm concerned, is just a synonym for coupon as gift card is, you know, given that, you seriously wonder what other language Congress could possibly use, particularly in the face of just the unending creativity and the enormous incentives of a lot of the attorneys who are litigating these cases as class counsel. You know, when you have that kind of creativity, you know, driving this and looking for all these loopholes, particularly among repeat players, you know, trying to patch these things with these types of Band-Aid fixes, ultimately is not the kind of thing that's going to fix, I think, the pathologies of these types of class action cases.
I think we are in violent agreement on this issue. Whether a remedy in a class settlement is called a coupon or a voucher or credit or a gift card, there is a body of there's a certain category of remedies that actually does have a useful role to serve in class settlements. I mean, there is a certain non-zero sum potential in remedies along the lines of vouchers or credits, at least in certain types of class actions. And I want parties to be able to construct sensible deals where they take advantage of the non-zero sum benefits of that remedy. But when courts are trying to determine the value of that remedy for purposes of approval of the settlement, and especially for purposes of determining attorney's fees, then they ought to be looking at what is the real value of that coupon, voucher, credit, or gift card remedy, and not what is some you know, fictitious face value of the remedy being offered. CAFA tried to address that, you know, did it using a particular word, and so now there's litigation about it. But frankly, I think any good judge doing the judge's job under Rule 23E in evaluating the fairness of a settlement and doing the judge's job at determining what's a fair amount of attorney's fees, that judge ought to be asking the question, what's the genuine value of the remedy in the settlement, regardless of whether you call it a coupon or a voucher or a credit or anything else.
Well, this is Dean Royer. You've both mentioned how incentives align here for the attorneys on both sides of this issue. That I suppose it's fair to say that those aligned incentives extend to the judge, to the extent the judge wants to get a case off his docket or her docket and move forward onto other cases.
You're exactly right, Dean.
Well, my question, follow-up if I could, is there a professional ethic, a disturbing professional ethical issue here? I would say with regard to the the defendant's attorneys, they're more or less serving their client because they're resolving potential legal liability, and they're doing it in a way that they think is at least financially responsible. To the extent there are coupons or things that both of you seem to assert have limited value or negligible value, to the extent named plaintiffs are getting more than class plaintiffs, can we really say the plaintiff's lawyers are zealously representing all their clients?
Well, I'll bite at that one. I think you're exactly right that there are ethical concerns when class action lawyers negotiate deals that don't really serve the interests of the class members. I do think you're going too easy on defendants' lawyers for this reason. The rules of professional conduct say that it's unethical for a lawyer to assist another lawyer in a violation of the rules. And so I think when defendants and class counsel, when defense lawyers and class action lawyers get together and negotiate deals that they know disserve the interests of the class, and where they know the value that they're going to be stating to the court is inflated and not reflective of the real value of the settlement remedies to the class, it seems to me they're both doing something unethical. Now, that said, I don't think the right solution to these problems is through the lawyer disciplinary process for either side. I think the reason we have the safeguard of Rule 23E, and the reason we give, that is judicial approval of settlements in class actions, is precisely so that we give the court the opportunity to look at whether the class is being treated fairly. But I do think the lawyers on both sides ought to worry about this.
Dean, I think your question, as well as Howard's answer, really do highlight some of the problems regarding incentives that are inherent to many of these types of actions, particularly when you have class members who have suffered, radically different degrees of injuries. Because, the incentives, for defense counsel, of course, it's to zealously represent their client. And in their view, they're holding an arm's length negotiation across the table from somebody who's representing the other side. But as a practical matter, the attorney on the other side, while nominally representing all of those class members, realistically is potentially trying to do something that's a little bit different that may not perfectly represent the interests of all of those class members, particularly where those class members' interests may be in conflict. And then subsequently, you have the judge who's supposed to be approving all of this, but the judge may not be getting the type of adversarial presentation that you get in every other instance, because you have the plaintiff's counsel and the defendant's counsel coming together to the court saying, please approve this settlement agreement. And you may or may not have an objector challenging it, and some of the objectors may be there for good reasons, like the Center for Class Action Fairness. They may be there trying to get a better deal for consumers, but you might also have objectors who are just trying to get a few bucks for themselves, where you might not have any whatsoever. And so you wind up with this problem of incentives, where the plaintiff's attorney may not have the incentive to represent all of the class members equally. The defendant's incentive is to obviously settle the case for the lowest price overall to the client. And then the judge's incentive, I think, Dean, as Dean recognized, is going to be, to give this as good of a look as possible, given the briefing before him or her, but ultimately to get the case off the docket, to keep the docket moving. When you put all those things together, it doesn't always work out the way that you would hope things would work out in litigation.
We've got a little more than 10 minutes left, two questions left as well, so now let's take another call.
Yeah, this is Milton Chappell from Virginia. I practice civil rights law, mainly utilizing Section 1983 litigations against governments and other states. And the attorney fee provision, among other sections of this bill, has real concerns in this area, because many times it's a change in behavior or policies with very low amounts of actual money damages, so that it would basically wipe out, as I see it, civil rights litigation and utilization of 1983, because the attorneys are restricted in their attorney's fees in a class case from getting either a percentage of the award, and I realize the court has to figure out what declaratory judgment value that is, but I guess what it is, I'd like both of you to comment on whether you think there's any reason whatsoever that this bill should apply to 1983 litigation.
Sure. Let me answer that quickly, because I think there may be a misapprehension here. The way the bill has been drafted, it actually doesn't affect the operation of Section 1988, which, of course, is the attorney's fee provision that applies in a number of civil rights actions, including Section 1983 actions. And that was actually, and it also does not apply. It only applies in a subsection B3 class actions, in other words, monetary relief class actions under Rule 23. And that was those two carve-outs were actually very deliberate on the part of the drafters of this bill because they did not want to affect the way that class action fee awards and incentives and so on would work in civil rights litigation. So you certainly identify something that could be an important issue, but I think it's one that's been dealt with in the way that this legislation has been drafted.
Then why did the committee refuse to amend the statute to make it clear the bill, that it doesn't even apply to 1983 litigation, if that was their intent?
I think the reason is that it's clear in the bill. There were a number of amendments that were proposed, but if I recall correctly, I believe that language actually was tweaked between the last Congress's version of the bill as well as this year. There may have been other amendments, but I'm unaware of the specific changes they would have made.
Well, you want to show me or just make quick reference to where it is that it's clear that it only applies to B3 and also that 1988 litigation is exempt? Because I know in one section it says, assuming no other law, you have to do the percentage, but then the next sentence says that there has to be a cap of the total amount given out, which doesn't seem to apply to the limitation of any other statute. I mean, again, I think the bill is just really badly drafted.
We've got a few more minutes left. One question pending. Do you want to respond? Howard Erickson?
Let me just jump in. So this is Howard. So I confess I have not dug into whether this provision would apply and somehow override 1988 or apply to civil rights fee shifting. I totally agree with the caller that it ought not, that fees in the whole point of fee shifting in civil rights cases is that we want lawyers to be able to pursue these claims even if the monetary stakes would not otherwise be high enough to incentivize it. And I would say more generally about there are two fee provisions really in the statute. One that in multi-district litigation basically caps fees and costs at 20%. I think that's very troubling, not just because it's too low a number and not just because it interferes with contracts, but because I think it really will change the whole dynamic of proceedings before the judicial panel on multi-district litigation on the decision about whether to send something to MDL. And then there's the fee provision about class actions that says that no fees can be awarded to class counsel until all money has been distributed to the class. Given that some class remedies extend for decades, that seems to me a really bad idea. I get what's motivating the provision, and I think it ought to be possible to come up with some sort of solution that involves interim fee payments to counsel, but the way it's drafted, it really just does seem to be an attack on class action lawyers.
Let's check in with our final caller now. Oops, I think we might have had a technical problem there and muted his or her phone. Go ahead, caller.
Hello. Yeah, it's David Emerson, Berkeley Federalist Society. Thanks, gentlemen, for your presentation. This is a bit of a follow-on to the prior question. And it still goes to this issue of attorney fee awards. And I think one of the speakers, I believe it was Mr. Grossman, was identified one of the roles of the class action as being its deterrence function rather than compensation. And my question is, is there are certain types of cases where there are in the aggregate potentially large damages, but they are so diffuse and the number in the class is so large that the uptake rate for filing and proving out claims is expected to be extremely low. In those cases, now, how does this bill address, in a positive manner, still the beneficial deterrent effect, the civil policing, the private AG effect that the class action plaintiff bar performs? And if I could also ask a related question to that, is that aren't there, consumer protection agencies at the state and federal level, or investor protection agencies, that arguably have a role here as well? And is it simply just that we are just partitioning them off for the sake of this discussion, or is they're part of the overall solution to the class action nexus?
Well, I think your question, hits on an important point, because when you're talking about the deterrent and prospective effect of class action litigation, in other words, the view of, class attorneys as effectively private attorneys general or something along those lines, it really does, I think, hit the question of, what is the proper role of class actions? What are we hoping to do by them? And, as so far as this bill is concerned, I think it really does in the main, take the position that for most cases involving consumers and involving class action, consumer type class actions, that regulation should probably be accomplished in the main by regulatory agencies and by law enforcement agencies, and that the real purpose of class actions is to provide this type of aggregated compensation mechanism. That said, as these provisions are drafted, it certainly does recognize that in many instances there may be a prospective equitable relief. Monetary relief may be limited in some instances, and it doesn't bar those kinds of cases, and indeed it provides still for attorney's fees in those instances. But I think the limitation in that case is that the bill is very clear that the attorney's fee award has to be based on the value to the class of whatever that equitable relief is. So it does flip the way that these things are calculated a little bit, but. Again, when you're trying to decide what the role is of these kinds of cases, I think it does stake out a position on something that has been a very longstanding debate going back decades.
On the question of the role of class actions in law enforcement, and I'd say more generally on the question of the role of civil litigation as a law enforcement mechanism, I think Andrew and I really do have quite different views. I think that in the American system, litigation does and ought to play a significant role in law enforcement. And the way I see it is we've got three choices. One is that we allow the law in significant ways to go unenforced, and I'm not a fan of that, even though I have disagreements with all sorts of particular aspects of substantive law as a general matter, I think, of the law. Second choice is we enforce the law by creating a massive government bureaucracy with consumer protection and investment protection agencies and so forth, with the power to intervene in all sorts of ways in our lives. And I don't think we've ever had the political will to take that approach. And the third is what I really think is a very American approach of letting private citizens find wrongdoing, see wrongdoing, and pursue wrongdoing, and then see what happens. It uses private incentives to try to get the job done, and I happen to think that plays an important role.
Very good. We've got about 60 seconds left. Let me give each of you really just 30 seconds to wrap up, if you could. And let's go in reverse order if you have any final thoughts. Professor Howard Erickson.
Yeah, I guess when I look at the bill as a whole, there are provisions that I just can't understand as genuine efforts to solve the real problems in class actions. And so when I ask myself, what is this bill doing? Ultimately, the only thing that holds together for me is it's an effort to make it much harder for plaintiffs to pursue litigation against the defendants. That sounds crass and cynical, but it's the way I end up seeing the bill. I've seen enough genuine good efforts to reform class actions and reform multi-district litigation, and this does not strike me as one of those efforts.
Final thought from Andrew Grossman.
Sure. I think when you talk with people who are litigating these cases in the trenches and see the abuses of our current consumer class action system, you recognize a lot of pathologies of that system, as well as just broken incentives that lead to results that don't benefit consumers, that don't benefit victims, that ultimately don't even do much to deter wrongdoing. I think the bill is actually a pretty sensible way to alter those incentives and to promote class actions that actually do advance the good while deterring the bringing of class actions that are mainly concerned with the enrichment of attorneys. On balance, I think that's a very good thing. And therefore, I think this type of legislation is something that could be very productive, both in terms of helping people who are actually injured, as well as reducing some of the excess and unnecessary costs of our class action litigation system.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it right there. My thanks to both of you, Professor Howard Erickson and Mr. Andrew Grossman. This has been an elucidating discussion. I thank you both. I want to thank the audience as well for joining and for your participation. And a reminder to the audience that our next scheduled teleforum conference call Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern time at the same number, we'll be speaking with Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson of the Fourth Circuit. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.